Well, in complete contrast to Jennifer's work, I'm talking about solicitors in the UK. So completely different group of women. Probably just as scary as female combatants, or there's combatants in other fields, I suppose. So yeah, talking about women solicitors in the UK and what's being done. So more specifically, I'm going to be talking about the problems that women solicitors face, and these are not just limited to women solicitors, they're related to probably most women in most professions, and not just limited to the UK, probably most developed countries and probably developing countries as well. I'm going to talk about some possible solutions to those problems that I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to talk specifically about the Law Societies of England and Wales and Scotland, because I'm doing my PhD in Scotland. And then I'm going to tell you about a couple of theories that I'm thinking about as the lenses through which I'm planning to analyse these strategies and policies of the Law Societies and draw a few conclusions. And I'd be really interested to hear your views on these. They're well-known theories, I'm sure you'll know about. You can probably throw tomatoes at me when I get to that, because you won't agree with what I'm saying. Can't see any tomatoes around, so hopefully I'll be all right. So, the problems. The biggest problem, I think, is probably the masculine culture of law firms. And as I said, it's not just law firms. So, a lot of organisations have a very kind of dominant male culture, and it's probably in law firms because they were started off by men. So they, when the legal profession first began, women weren't allowed to join. So it was designed by men for men to suit them. Thank you very much. You know, that's what they did, and it's barely changed since. So although women have been allowed to qualify as solicitors since about, I think the first one in England and Wales was 1922, it hasn't changed terribly much. So we're talking about full-time working, long hours, macho culture, client entertainment in the evening, presenteeism, jacket on the back of the chair, that, you know, kind of when everyone else is going home, that sort of thing. And as I said, it's not just law firms, although I think they're particularly bad at it. And then indirect discrimination. So direct discrimination is the kind of thing that you go, ooh, can't do that, and bring a claim. And then you've got indirect discrimination, which is a lot more common and much more difficult to prove. So a provision criterion or practice that disadvantages the women in this case. So I mentioned client entertainment in the evenings, and that's very common. And it's the kind of thing that now you've seen Jennifer has to go because she has to go and get her daughter fed and watered and to bed. And then I've left mine in the capable hands of my mum so that I could come here. Now, there's not something you can do every night when you're at work. And you know, so, you know, your male colleagues are staying on and then they're going for drinks and the rest of it. And if you've got children at home, I'm skipping now to the fourth bullet point, the domestic burden is hugely on the women, although things are changing slowly. So indirect discrimination, I think, is one of the issues that women still face in law firms. And unequal pay is another one. You kind of think, well, we're in 2015, surely that doesn't happen. It does. And, you know, generally the kind of headline figure is that women are paid one third less than men. And it's not actually as bad as that when you take into account the difference in post-qualification experience, so equity level compared to junior solicitors and that kind of thing. But there is still a difference. And it's not that huge. It's not the third, as the kind of the headline rate says. But there's still a difference, and there shouldn't be a difference. Why on earth would a man doing the same job as a woman be paid more than she is? So that is still, it still happens. So that's another issue. And then the domestic burden, which I've mentioned already, it's still the women that do most of it. And it's not only related to children. We're talking about who books the holidays, who pays the bills. It's not just, you know, when the children come along, though it gets a lot harder when there are children involved than when the child's ill at school. Who does the school ring? Mainly the mum. And who's doing the shopping, and all, it's still mainly a burden on women. And so all of these reasons, all of these problems and more, lead to this leaky pipeline. I love this expression, the leaky pipeline, and I found this fabulous photo of a leaky pipeline. So what I'm basically saying is approximately 80% of partners are men, because although starting off there are at least 50% women joining the profession, and in fact for the past more than 20 years there have been more women entering the legal profession than men, they get to kind of early 30s and they start thinking about getting married and having family, and then quite often up until they have their first child they're okay, and then they go on the maternity leave and they're like, yes, I'm coming back and I'm going to work full time, it's all going to be fine and great, and then they get back and they go, mm. Or they think about going back and they think, oh, I don't want to work full time, I want to work part time, but there aren't the opportunities available to continue your career and progress in the way that you would if you were full time and male or female and childless. To do that, so there's a mass exodus, and there's this huge leaky pipeline. There's more than a leak. There's a mass exodus of women from the legal profession in their early 30s, and as I said, it's not just the legal profession. It's not just the UK, but it's in quite a lot of professions, and it's quite a big problem. So possible solutions. There needs to be a culture change within the profession. As I said, it's not changed terribly much since the beginning of the profession. So flexible working, part-time working, remote working and job sharing for both men and women needs to be normalised, it needs to be accepted. And there, you know, there are all these super snazzy laws and the right to request flexible working. And of course, I'm not saying there are no part-time lawyers across the UK, that of course there are. But what I'm saying is that when people go for these options, it tends to limit their progression. So you can do it, and for some people it may work wonderfully, and I hope it does, and I'm sure it does for some, but for the majority it's an issue and it needs to be normalised, and people need to be able to do it, men and women, without kind of getting stuck at that level or people kind of looking at them and are you going home now, and you know, that kind of thing. So if law firms reassess the measures that they use for success, the things that they think indicate success, and if they clarify promotion criteria in law firms, I think that will help, because the two kind of traditional markers for being promoted to partner are billing targets and bringing in new business. This is what kind of everybody focuses on if they want to become partner, and then the law firms don't take notice of a load of other things that are going on, and there are things like, for example, training the trainees, and quite often that's something that research says women are better at doing, or you know, the trainees say that they got better training from their female partners who were in charge of them when they were training than the men. And also put with the billing, the bringing in new clients, bringing in the new ones might be happening on the golf course, or it might be happening in the bars and things, but what about retaining the clients and focusing on the client relationships that you have and keeping your clients happy so that they stay with you? That's not even looked at, that's not taken into account as a criteria for promotion to partner. And it's quite often discretionary, which is always a problem, because then how are you going to bring a claim, or how are you going to say, well, I didn't get that, so, you know, because it was all terribly discretionary. So I'm saying you need to increase gender awareness and diversity inclusion training. So things like unconscious bias, they don't even know they're doing it. So they're faced with, you know, these candidates, and this one went to the same school as he did, or went to the same university as he did, or speaks with the same accent as him, and he doesn't realise that he's choosing that candidate over another. So just to bring this awareness about, I think is going to help the situation. And then this is really controversial, probably not in this room, but in the world outside, affirmative action or positive discrimination. I've put a question mark next to that, because it's not something that, you know, necessarily the world will accept or, you know, we are ready for in this country. But they're starting to introduce gender targets in some of the very big law firms, the firms that are kind of showing their clients that their corporate social responsibility is really important to them. And there's a firm called Ashurst who have got a target for, I think it was 17% or up to 25%, I can't remember the exact figures, but it's starting to happen. But interestingly, it's only for new partners, so they're not saying we're going to, you know, make sure our whole partnership is 25% women, it's just the new partners. And you would have thought, if for the past more than 20 years there have been more women coming in than men, surely that's going to happen anyway. But with the leaky pipeline, it's not. So I think we need targets. But as I said, not going down terribly well. So the Law Society of England and Wales have been looking at this issue for a number of years, and they've done lots and lots of research of their own. So in my PhD, I'm not attempting to compete with the Law Society of England and Wales or Scotland. I haven't got the resources they've got. I haven't got the team of researchers that they've got. It's just me. So I'm using the research that they've done and analysing it, as I said, through the lens of these couple of theories, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. So there's this whole raft of literature and strategies and policies that they've put together, and the kind of flagship thing is this charter, the Diversity and Inclusion Charter, which they're asking law firms to sign up to. And it's a number of statements that say, you know, we're going to have an equality and diversity policy, and we're going to implement it, and we're going to monitor the figures each year on gender and ethnicity and the rest of it, and the disability and all of those things. And they've got quite a lot of firms signing up, and it's kind of a work in progress, and they're updating it and renewing it. They're just doing it now, and we're waiting for the updated version. So 2009 is the first version, and there should be an updated one coming out soon. So they had this International Women in Law Summit in 2012, which I was lucky enough to attend. And I didn't realise at the time that it was going to be such a key day. But the legacy report that came out of that has been used to as a basis for their later strategies that they've published after that. And it was one of these days where they had loads of American lawyers from the American Bar Association, and they had speakers from Singapore and this kind of thing. And on the day, we had loads of these votes with interactive voting on the tables, and it was a really big deal. And they asked loads of questions, and they used the results of the votes from the delegates on the day to look at, to kind of inform their own policy. So they had the Career Barriers Action Plan, the framework, and then the Lexel accreditation is something a bit different. It's something, well, it's similar to the charter in that it's something law firms can sign up to, and but they've included bits of the charter into it. And Principle 9 regulation requirements, Principle 9 requirements are compulsory monitoring that law firms have to do every year, which hasn't gone down very well either. And if you read the comments that people write on the Law Society Gazette website, there's this one particular individual who's answering everything. And there was another interesting article yesterday, and I thought, oh, I bet that guy's going to comment on that. And he did, and he's there. I think he's got nothing else to do. And it's quite interesting, because I think he represents probably quite a large proportion of the kind of male partnership out there, and he definitely represents people I remember from practice, and you know, one of my bosses in the past, and it's not him. Well, maybe it is him, and he's got the different name, his pen name, but I think he's quite typical of the membership of the Law Society of England and Wales. So they've got a new strategy that has just been published as well, 2014-15, going on to 2016-17. So that goes up to about the end of my PhD. So I shall make some predictions as to what's going to be in that. And then the Law Society of Scotland, they came to it a little bit later. It's a much smaller jurisdiction in Scotland, and it's so much easier to navigate. So I've spoken to the head of equality and diversity at both law societies for my research, and the chap in Edinburgh, he was so lovely. And as soon as I emailed him, he came back. He's like, "Yeah, sure, I'll put the kettle on," and this kind of thing. He was so lovely, and it was so easy to access him and speak to him. And he said to me, "Anything else you want to know, just email me." And he was really, really, really nice. And he's been in charge of these documents being produced. And one of the things that struck me is that he really highlighted in my interview with him, and it's also in the documents, mainstreaming of diversity and inclusion in everything that they do at the Law Society. And what they've also said, which is a bit different to England and Wales, is that they're kind of threatening making these things compulsory if things don't improve. So this is kind of guidance, and it's up to you if you do this. But they're saying, if you don't, we are then going to make it compulsory that you do this, in particular in relation to equal pay. So they seem to be a little bit, already being a bit firmer, and I think they're probably learning from the experience of England and Wales. So possible theories for analysis. I'm talking about sameness, difference, and this is the stage that I'm at now. This is a chapter on writing, so I'm kind of a bit sort of, and I don't know. So if you do think that this is horrific, please feel free to tell me at the end, because I know sameness, difference has been going on since the 80s, and Gilligan and Hakim, that's where you might get your tomatoes at. I don't know. So the sameness, difference debate, as I'm sure you all know, has been going on since the 1980s. And what they're basically saying is, are we the same, are women the same as men, or are women different to men? And regardless of what we think, what should we argue? So the sameness approach says that women and men are the same and they should be treated as such, because if we argue differently, if we argue that women are different to men, then that necessarily weakens women's position because we're not the same as men, so they obviously think we're not as good as them. But in this view, equality means that everyone should be treated the same, but it doesn't produce an equality of outcome. So that what use is that really? By contrast, the difference approach says that men and women are different, and the norms that were created by men are seen as neutral, but they're not neutral, they're necessarily male, because the men made them up and women had no input into that. So a revaluation is necessary to give more importance to traits which are seen as more common in women, but they're not female traits, they're human traits, and men also have them. And they're undervalued and unappreciated in society and in the workplace. And these are the sorts of things I mentioned earlier on about criteria for promotion to partner. It's that kind of thing that I'm thinking about when I say that there. So looking at the work of Carol Gilligan and Catherine Hakim. So Carol Gilligan, as you probably know, is an American psychologist. And in 1982, she had... And I've got it with me if anyone would just show you that. I'm sure you've got it in your library, in a different voice. So she looked at the differences between girls and boys in moral reasoning, and she concluded that girls bury their honest voice and they edit what they say to fit in with what they think they should be saying. And she's been criticised, as every theorist in the world has been criticised. Her criticism was mainly for her being essentialist, among other criticisms. But she's answered her critics, and she's had her most recent book, 2011, called Joining the Resistance, Answering Most Things. And one of my favourite quotes from that is on page 22. So within a patriarchal framework, care is a feminine ethic, but within a democratic framework, care is a human ethic, which I think sort of sums up what I think is important about what she's saying in relation to my work. Catherine Hakim... they even talked about her on that horrific programme on Channel 5 that's on in the mornings called The Right Stuff. And I was on maternity leave at the time, and when I saw it, I was like, Catherine Hakim, The Right Stuff. So obviously that's the level of her, right. Of the way people are looking at her work. So she's not a feminist. She's a sociologist, and she doesn't call herself an economist, but what she talks about is kind of represents free market economist views. And in her 2000 book, she talks about her preference theory, where she says all women choose to be work-centred, home-centred or adaptive, and she assumes that women can make a genuine free choice. But she doesn't take any notice of, you know, what jobs are available or what women's inner voice is telling them to do or not do, what whether childcare is affordable to them or their partner's views in the situation. She's also been criticised for being essentialist and a lot of other things. And in her also 2011 book called Honey Money, The Power of Erotic Capital, which I was reading on the train on the way up, it's really quite amusing. she said that women should use their sexuality to get ahead by exploiting the male sexual deficit, and she calls it sexonomics, and it's simple sexonomics apparently. So we should all be using our sexuality, our erotic capital, it's more than sexuality, it's erotic capital, to get ahead in the workplace apparently. So we're all doing that wrong, I'm sure. So the conclusions that I'm briefly drawing are the following. So the law societies, both England and Wales and Scotland, they tend to assume sameness, if we're talking about the difference between sameness and difference in that debate. But there are a few points where there are some elements of difference that they're talking about. So for example, the Law Society of Scotland talks about wider criteria for promotion to partnership, which I've mentioned is something I think is really important. And the Law Society of England and Wales talks about gender targets, but they're not, and the way it's worded is that they're going to suggest that all law firms do this. So when I spoke to the head of Equality and Diversity of England and Wales, and I said to her, does this mean that you're going to tell them all to have targets? She said, no. And I was like, because it sounded so promising in what I had read, but the reality, I think, is that it's a suggestion, but they're not going to force anyone to do it. So Hakeem, in her free market economic standpoint, sits very comfortably with law firms because it's all about making money and they like doing that. But more of Gilligan's different feminist principles need to be adapted as well into their criteria promotion to value the contribution that women are making and value women's worth in the profession, because at the moment they're just leaving, and there's a business case for that as well, because there's a huge investment that they're making in these women and then they're losing them. So law firms need to reevaluate the criteria to promotion for promotion to partner and recognise the value of the contribution that women are making. And law firms need to truly accept flexible working as part of a modern working culture and not allow it to harm the career progression of people that choose to work flexibly or take time off for caring for men and women, not just women, of course. So I'd be interested to hear your views or your questions. That's my email and my Twitter if anybody wants to get in touch afterwards.